Okay. Brother Chuck's passing out the lesson. And did you all get yours from chapter 5? Did I give that to you?
One sheet,
mm-hmm.
Class number 5, is that all
there was? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So tonight we're in lesson 6, and lesson 6 of Christian Evans is on dinosaurs, reason, and revelation. Now, you might wonder why it is that we would include a full lesson on dinosaurs in Christian Evans. And does anybody have any idea? Why are we talking about dinosaurs tonight?
That's the most drawing aspect to young children, especially.
Yes.
The entire evolution of the universe is dinosaurs. Of course, all kids or most kids are fascinated with dinosaurs.
Yes.
Age of the earth, and man was here at the same time, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yes, and next time we're going to cover the age of the earth, and by the way, that'll be the end of our first section. The first section is the existence of God. We're going to have a test. It's going to be the largest section. The other sections are smaller, but there's so much focus on the existence of God and attacks against it today that it's going to be the largest section. So by the end of our next class, we'll have a test, and I'll... Those that are taking this for credit, I'll give you the review on that. So yes, it is a way in which most people are introduced to evolution. The first thing we have here is why study the dinosaurs. The majority of people out there believe that dinosaurs are proof of the general theory of evolution, of macroevolution. And it's claimed that they became extinct maybe 65 million years ago, several million years ago, and they believe that man came on the scene only a few million years ago, or a few hundred thousand years ago. And so they believe that there's over 60 million years that separate us and the dinosaurs. And so most people, especially children, are very fascinated with dinosaurs, and we do have the evidence there in front of us. You can't just go to a museum and see the bones there in front of you and deny that these things existed. They're right there. But then we see these plaques underneath, the huge long name of the dinosaur, and then believed to exist so many million years ago. And so right then, a child, maybe by the time they're 5 years old, has already been taught Darwinian evolution by introduction to the dinosaurs, and because they're so fascinated with it. And as parents and as members of the church, you know, we ought to be concerned about our children and what they're being taught, and especially at a young age. And so it's interesting how they get evolution, they creep it in there as early as they do. Many people laugh at the idea that dinosaurs existed at the same time that man did. But if you're going to believe what the Bible says, then you pretty much have to believe that, right? Because on what day were land animals created? Day 6, right? And what day was man created?
Day 6.
Day 6. And so the separation at most is 23 hours, right? Not 65 million years as they would claim. Well, if man and dinosaur actually... did exist at the same time, then maybe we would find some evidence for that. And the fact is that actually there is plenty of evidence for it. But it's evidence that you're not going to find in your children's textbooks. It's evidence that you don't hear talked about very much, or that you see basically as just dismissed as myth. First of all, we have stories of dinosaurs and dragons. And, we all talk about it. Are you serious that we're going to talk about legends of dragons and how they factor into this? Well, yes. I realize that there have been some embellishments along the line under letter B, a dragon with multiple heads guarding some treasure. I realize that we embellish things, but don't those go back to something that's actually couched in truth? If somebody says, "I've caught a fish this big," there is, they did catch a fish, but it's probably not that big. And, you know, that, so they're adding things to it, but they are couched in actual truth. And it's isn't it interesting how similar dinosaurs and dragons are? I mean, a large lizard, and the idea that we would fight them. And so there are many accounts of this, and I have two outlines for you. If you look behind here, these are two pages all talking about different legends and stories that have documentation of stories of large lizards. And, you know, some of them obviously have some things that are embellished. But just like we talked about with the worldwide flood, isn't it interesting that every world culture has a story of a universal flood? Doesn't that point to something? Why would it be the case that all these different cultures would come up with a creature that is a large lizard and have so many similar stories about it, so many similar ideas about it, and, as we'll see later, drawings about it? And so we have here the idea that the term dinosaur was not even termed until 1842. Okay, so just because they don't call it a dinosaur doesn't mean that's not. And when we come to the Bible, when was the King James Version translated? 1611. Other English Bibles a little bit earlier than that, and even Bibles that have been translated after that. They want to do justice to the text, and they don't want to insert any idea. They just want to, interpret it literally and have you figure it out for yourself. So sometimes they won't include dinosaur even at that. They'll just say a great beast or a creature. And so just because they don't use the word dinosaur doesn't mean that that's not what we're talking about. Look on the right of the first page I gave you. In Ireland, we have Tristan of Lyonesse slew a dragon in the 11th century. We have a story from France, Drake and the Rhone River. We have another one from France there, a couple from Germany, Edward Topsell, 1608, plagued by a dragon, Bonn, Germany, a lindworm, which is a two-footed dragon, as it's two-legged dragon, as it's talked about before, Italy, Russia. So there are several of these, and one that I thought that was very interesting is on the second page here. Many people in school read of Beowulf, and that has a great creature in there. And I'm not saying that these are completely factual in everything that they're talking about, but I'm saying that it all points to the same thing from different cultures. All points to these great creatures. And if they never existed, why would all of these cultures come up with the same mythological creature? Why is it that you go to China and you find the great dragon, and then you go to Europe and you have these dragon stories of times past? And so we would expect that if at one time they did exist and then became extinct, that people would tell stories about it. But not only that, we would expect that maybe they would draw some pictures of it. Of course, they didn't have their cell phone there where they could take a picture of it, but they would have taken some pictures of it. And what I want to do for the next 15 or maybe a little bit longer, maybe 18 minutes, is look at this section of a lecture that Brad Harrop has, and he can give you these this evidence more succinctly than I can, and the pictures are on there, and so. I just wanted to kind of let him do this part of the lecture because he's going to do better than me. So let's look at this, and this are pictures that people have drawn, that ancient man has drawn, of the dinosaurs. Hopefully this will play and be loud enough.
For instance, January 2005, American researchers discovered a dinosaur that had been eaten by a mammal. It was a fossilized mammal that had a dinosaur in its belly. Now you say, yeah, Brad, so what? What's the big deal? Folks, remember the evolutionary timeline. According to that theory, mammals didn't come into the picture until millions of years later. And yet, we've got a mammal that was eating a dinosaur. Or maybe somebody could explain the Ica Stones of Peru. A gentleman by the name of Dr. Javier Cabrera was given one of these stones as a birthday present. There's a doctor down in Lima, Peru. He looked at that stone. He noticed it had elegant carvings on it. He went back to the farmer who had discovered that particular stone and given it to him. He asked him, he said, "Where'd you find this?" And the farmer explained, he said, "Ah, those are burial stones that the ancient Incan Indians used to place in their tombs." In fact, Javier Cabrera remembered his father owning such stones. He set out to find as many of them as he could. All told, he found about 11,000 of them. And over a third of those 11,000 show very elegant pictures of dinosaurs on them. But folks, not just dinosaurs. There's dinosaurs and men. And you say, "Oh, this is just an internet hoax." In fact, if you go online, there may be some websites that try to tell you that these are a hoax. But I would ask you again to evaluate the evidence. You see, the early Incas got things right that we've only just recently uncovered. For instance, they were placing dermal frills on the back of these cirrhopod dinosaurs. Dermal frills. Something that researchers didn't discover until the year 1992. Other stones had these bumpy rosette patterns on the back of dinosaurs. And again, researchers looked at that and said, "That's not accurate. We've never seen that." That was until we found some fossilized skin from a dinosaur that had those bumpy rosette patterns in 1998. You see, folks, the early Incas got it right the first time. It's only been within just the last decade or so that we have learned the rest of the story, so to speak. My question would be, how did those early Incas know what to draw if they had never seen those particular creatures? Or maybe somebody could explain to me the dinosaur figurines from Acambal, Mexico. If you were to go there today, there's a mountain called El Toro, the bull. And it's at the foothills of that particular mountain that a gentleman, he was riding on the back of a horse, and from that elevated position, he saw the first of these ceramic figurines. Now, all told, they found roughly 30,000 of these. And again, many of them so well detailed, you can actually tell what kind of dinosaur it is. Ironically, they sent these pieces of these dinosaurs off to two laboratories here in the United States to try to have them dated. They want to know, how old are these things? So they sent it off to the University of Pennsylvania and a place called Teledyne Labs. They really wanted to try to narrow down exactly when the culture who had made these particular figurines was living. Came back with dates of roughly 2000 BC. 2000 BC. That would imply that men had been living with the dinosaurs. So they sent 8 additional samples to be what's called thermoluminescent testing. They really wanted to make sure they had this thing right. Sure enough, it came back with dates of roughly 2000 BC as well. It was at that point that they called both laboratories. They said, "Hey, you know that material we're sending you? It came from dinosaur figurines." At which point, both laboratories did the same thing. They withdrew their results. They said, "We're sorry, we're unable to give you any accurate readings on your material." But in 1990, one of those institutions got caught, so to speak. University of Arizona. 1990, the University of Arizona was sent some dinosaur bones. They weren't told that that was what it was. They were simply told, "This is a blind study. We'd like for you to date this material." They did. Came back with dates of roughly 9,000 years before present. Now, granted, 9,000 years is not precisely 6,000. But folks, that's a far cry from 65 million. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the Buddhist temple in Cambodia, 800 years old, that was just recently uncovered there in the dense jungles. Men stumbled across this temple. And folks, you can't fake this one. Vines had completely covered it up. They came in with what you and I might call industrial strength Roundup. They pulled back the vines, they burned them in a pile, and when they did that, they noticed elegant carvings all over this temple. A couple of friends of mine, preachers from the Denver area, have actually had the opportunity to visit this firsthand. They've given me several of their pictures. And they showed me how the man who had built this particular temple, he carved things intricately, like, for instance, a monkey. Or he carved a deer. But he didn't just stop with monkeys and deers. He also carved dinosaurs. Dinosaurs so specific that you can look at it and tell precisely what type of dinosaur it is. For instance, a stegosaurus. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the dinosaur petroglyphs, the National Bridges National Monument. If you were to go there today, just outside of Blanding, Utah, there are three natural sandstone bridges, one of which is called Kachina. It's on that particular sandstone bridge that early Anasazi Indians, they carved all kinds of things. For instance, if you were to go there today, there's a sandstone bridge called Kachina that has got bighorn sheep on it. But they didn't just stop with bighorn sheep. They also carved dinosaurs. In fact, an evolutionist by the name of Fran Barnes, he is an authority on rock art in the American Southwest. I want you to listen very carefully to what he said regarding this particular petroglyph. He said, there's a petroglyph in Natural Bridges National Monument that bears a striking resemblance to a dinosaur. Now, why do you think he didn't just call it a dinosaur? Remember what Philip Kitcher said. Solid evidence of humans coexisting with dinosaurs would shake the foundations of the evolutionary theory. So on that same particular bridge that we find other creatures, even things like flying reptiles, you remember those pterodactyls, pterodons? I want to share with you two quotes that I hope you will remember. They're not real flashy. They don't have a lot of picture to them. But to me, they pack a massively powerful punch. Because they're coming from historians. They're talking about these flying reptiles. Now, again, bear in mind, evolutionists would have us believe that pterodactyls, pteranodons, that they lived 65 million years ago, that they died out with the dinosaurs during the age of the dinosaurs. And yet, I want us to go all the way back to the 5th century B.C., when a historian by the name of Herodotus, listen to what he said. Herodotus said, there's a place in Arabia to which I went on hearing of some winged serpents. When I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents in such quantities as it would be impossible to describe. The form of the serpent is like that of a water snake, but he has wings without feathers, and like as possible to the wings of a bat. You see, Herodotus knew. He knew that these flying reptiles were real. But he's not the only one. In fact, many of you may be familiar with a historian by the name of Josephus, Jewish historian. A Jewish historian who actually lived during the time that many of the apostles were walking the earth. Josephus was a man who chronicled the life and death of Jesus Christ at the hands of Pilate. But he also talked about those flying reptiles. Listen carefully to what he said. When the ground was difficult to be passed over, because of the multitude of serpents, which it produces in vast numbers, some of which ascend out of the ground unseen, and they also fly in the air, and they do come upon men at unawares and do them a mischief. He said, Moses made baskets like unto arks of sage, and filled them with eaves or birds, and carried them along with him, Which animal is the greatest enemy to the serpents imaginable? For they fly from them when they come near them, and as they fly, they're caught and they're devoured by them. All right, so let me get this straight. The same historian who wrote about a man named Jesus Christ being crucified by Pilate is also writing about flying reptiles? Friends, what does that do to the evolutionary theory? Keeping in mind, Josephus wrote this long before Charles Darwin was ever even a thought. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the tomb of Richard Bell. If you ever get over to Carlisle Cathedral in England, let me encourage you to walk through it and ask them to roll up the carpet that you see there, right in the middle of the cathedral. Below that particular carpet, there is the tomb of a man who died in 1496. Now, bear in mind, the word dinosaur itself came into existence roughly in round numbers 350 years later. So here you've got a guy who dies in 1496. With that carpet rolled up, you'll see that beautiful marble elegant tomb where the tomb maker had carved all kinds of animals into it. Animals that you can very easily distinctly tell. For instance, a fox or an eel, a cat or a dog, and even dinosaurs. Roughly 350 years before the word dinosaur was even coined. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the textiles from the Nazca tombs. A friend of mine by the name of Dr. Dennis Swift, he actually goes down there on a fairly regular basis to do digs. He keeps trying to get me to come with him. Our schedules are conflicting nonstop, but he shared with me this last time, he said, Brad, we discovered what we believe is a child's raincoat, where there's a dinosaur embroidered in the bottom of it. Now again, the question becomes, how did these Nazcas know what to sew or draw or paint if they had never seen it? Or maybe somebody could explain to me the discovery of Dr. Samuel Hubbard. Dr. Samuel Hubbard was not a religious fundamentalist by any means, not a preacher. He was not a creationist with an axe to grind. Dr. Samuel Hubbard, he was the curator for the Museum of Natural History in Oakland, California. He set out to prove what he thought about the American Indians. Dr. Hubbard believed that they had been on this continent much longer than we were giving them credit for. So he set out on an expedition down into the Grand Canyon. They went off one of the side canyons to the Havasupai Canyon. And he began to look for things like their pottery or clothing. Anything that would prove that, yes, those Indians had been here. And lo and behold, he was right. He found their pottery. He found their clothing, but he also stumbled across the cave art. Etched into those canyon walls, there were pictures that had taken men literally hours to carve out. And you say, okay, Brad, pictures of what? Well, let's see. There was buffalo, sheep, dinosaurs, oxen, men. Wait a second, run that list by me one more time. So buffalo, sheep, oxen, men, and dinosaurs. In fact, I want to read to you what Dr. Hubbard had to say regarding his find. He said, taken all in all, the proportions are quite good. The huge reptile is depicted in the attitude in which man would most likely see it, reared on its hind legs, balancing with a long tail, either in a fighting position, or feeding position, or a fighting position, possibly defending itself against a party of men. He goes on to say, the fact that some prehistoric man made a pictograph of a dinosaur on the walls of this canyon upsets completely all of our theories regarding the antiquity of man. The fact that the animal is upright and balanced on its tail would seem to indicate that the prehistoric artist must have seen it alive. Now, I want to show you a picture of exactly what Dr. Hubbard found, and I hate to be the one to tell you, And folks, if you look very carefully, it's not a cow. It's not an ox. It's not a sheep. It's not a man. But it's an awfully good representation of a dinosaur we now know existed called the Edmontosaurus. Again, the question falls, how did they know what to draw? Or maybe somebody could explain to me the soft tissue that was discovered in a T-Rex bone not too long ago. A lady by the name of Mary Schweitzer made this discovery. I actually communicated with her about it. Turned out that discovery was literally a serendipitous event. They had the long bone, the femur of this T-Rex. They had encased it in plaster Paris. They wanted to take it back to a laboratory. They rented a helicopter. The helicopter landed. Lo and behold, that block of material, it was too big. It physically would not fit into the helicopter. So she realized they were going to have to break it. They decided to cut it right down the middle. And when they did that, they were able to look inside that T-Rex bone where they found soft tissue, blood vessels, and what she believes may be blood cells. Now friends, you ask any molecular biologist worth their salt at all, they're going to tell you, soft tissue, blood vessels, blood cells, they don't stick around for 65 million years. You see, we have the evidence. But whether or not our young people are going to be exposed to it is a whole different matter. We have burial claws from Peru dating back roughly 500, 700 AD that clearly show dinosaur-like creatures on it. We've got the Roman murals from the 2nd century AD showing two long-necked dragons. Bear in mind, folks, that's hand-laid tiles. Hand-laid tiles by men who were living basically one generation after the apostles. We have the Mesopotamian cylinder seal that looks an awful lot like what you and I would call an apatosaurus today. Or maybe somebody could explain the tablets that are attributed to Denarmer, the legendary first pharaoh of United Egypt, that clearly show dinosaur-like creatures on it. Do you get the point? We could go on and on and on, but I think the point has been made. Friends, dinosaurs coexisted with man.
Yeah, that's hopefully been a little bit enlightening to you. So as you can see, not only do we have legends and stories, hopefully your eyes are evolving for the light. Not only do we have legends and stories, but we also have pictures artist drawings and the question is, how would they know? And so certainly we have the evidence that man and dinosaurs did exist. Does anybody have any comments or questions on that before we move on to this last part? Okay, and the last section, the remaining time I have here, I want to look at the Bible.
I looked at Brad on some other things, and I thought he has proposed in the past that because of the Noah's flood was a changing, you know, lost the canopy of the earth, and that's when dinosaurs became extinct. But he was talking about things that were in over 800 years ago or something.
It's a popular theory that, you know, they died in the flood. But I think that the evidence is towards the fact that maybe they were on the ark, and then because of the climate that changed so much afterwards, we talk about how the people lived very long time, you know, before the atmosphere and the change of it made the climate change quite a bit. It was very warm all over the earth, and since dinosaurs need a lot of, they're cold-blooded, since they need a lot of vegetation, they perhaps were not as well suited for the post-flood world as compared to the pre-flood. And I think actually he believes that they actually existed afterwards. And something I noted on the outline is the fact that, you know, as most of the legends that talk about dinosaurs, they talk about men slaying them. And, you know, what do we usually do to things that threaten us? We usually kill them off, right? For instance, in Asia,
certain parts of Asia, there's, you know, people documenting their travels there. You know, years and years back, they said there were so many tigers there that, you know, you had to be real careful. But now tigers are almost extinct. So I think that the two of those add together. You know, I don't see a very strong evidence why anything would just kill off the dinosaurs and nothing else at the same time. So when you have something like in the 1400s, I think that there were still some existing along those times.
That's amazing. You wouldn't need to feed a bunch of people. Get one of those and you'd be good for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, if Shem, Ham, and Japheth come out of the ark, and now some people disagree with me on this, but I think before the ark, before the flood, people just ate vegetation. The Bible says in Genesis 1 that the herb is given to you for food. But if you go to Genesis 9, it says that the meat or the flesh of animals will be given to you as the herb. And so God gives the permission and the authority for them to eat animals. Well, if I'm Shem, Ham, or Japheth, and I'm told by Father Noah to go out and kill something to eat, if I got a possum or something here, and then I have this big guy, I'm going to be able to eat on him for months, right? So, yeah, I know who I'm going for. I'd rather be eating dinosaur than possum. So, I guess that's part of that. And let me also mention, too, something I forgot to mention is, you know, the whole breathing fire part. I think that's very possible. For instance, you know, the government is very concerned about the output of methane that our cows are producing. You know, and they, in fact, are measuring it, see the effect because of global warming and everything like that that they're scared about. Well, if something the size of a cow can produce that much methane to get our government in such a concern, imagine how much methane a dinosaur could produce. And then, you know, there are many creatures that would really defy your imagination if I tried to tell you about them if you'd never heard of them before. I can give a couple of examples. For instance, there are there's the bombardier beetle, who actually chemically is able to cause explosions in order to ward off predators. And for instance, if you never had heard of an electric eel before, and I said that there's this thing that stands in the water that is able to deliver some voltage, you know, and it doesn't shock itself, doesn't shock its mate while it's mating, and yet at the same time is able to do that in the water, you think I'm crazy, unless you had heard about it before. And so really all you need is a gas like methane and something to ignite it with. So I don't think it's really out of the question. In fact, in some of the, there's a fossil that is in Indianapolis Children's Museum, that is said to be the dragon dinosaur. And in some of these dinosaurs, they had hollow parts around their nostrils that they didn't know what they were used for. They didn't know what the tubes were used for. So there's a lot that we don't know, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they could shoot sparks and fire. And I think the reason I believe in that, especially even more, is what the Bible has to say in Job 41, which is what we're about to look at. Does anybody have anything else on that before we move to what the Bible says?
Just a passing thought. You know, we've had a lot of animals that's gone extinct in just several generations, you know, that we have records of, certain tigers and certain birds and all this. Why would it be unthinkable that something, either through time or through man or whatever circumstance, that the dinosaurs disappeared by the same means? You know, we talk about and hear scientists talk about these animals that existed, you know, maybe several hundred years ago, but they did exist and existed for a long time, and then they died out. So it wouldn't be unthinkable that the dinosaurs would follow the same course.
Right.
And like other animals, will probably follow in the years to come, before the Lord tarries.
Yep.
And Noah took, just like God said, of every kind of animal that was on Earth,
right,
a male and a female. So I think that they were alive then. You know, afterwards, they could have been extinct through killing, man killing, whatever environment, whatever might have happened.
And you don't have to. He didn't have to take full-grown adults either. He could have taken juveniles. And in fact, if you're going to have the best mating, you know, possibilities afterwards, you would probably want to take juveniles, which would be smaller to take. You wouldn't want a dinosaur that's on its last breath to be your hope for, you know. I think if somebody has made the joke before, I don't think Noah brought animals that were all carrying AARP cards onto the onto the ark. So
carry cards, and I'll be careful.
Give me off the ark. Oh, okay. So going to what the Bible says about dinosaurs. First, obviously, the word dinosaur is not in there. But we've already given the reasons for it, and the Bible predates the term dinosaur. But on top of that, the idea that that the Bible has to mention something for it to teach that it existed is not true. The Bible doesn't have to teach. The Bible doesn't have to mention the duck-billed platypus for us to believe that it existed, or for us to think that the Bible. If the Bible doesn't mention it, do we automatically assume that the Bible teaches that it didn't exist? I mean, that is quite that's putting quite a bad requirement on the Bible. I know I've heard of a man that wouldn't believe the Bible because the Bible didn't mention the pyramids. Well, you know, does the Bible have to mention everything? It's God's message to me, and I think one of the points that we're going to look at later on in this study about the Bible being inspired is it doesn't go into the curiosities that man wants to hear about. Gives us what we need. And so to say that it has to mention it is not true. But I do think that the Bible does talk about things that would fall under this category. Genesis 1:21 is the first thing that I have listed there in the creation account. The Bible says that God created great whales, every living creature that moveth the waters, and they brought forth abundantly. So there were great creatures in the sea that were created. Job 7, verse 12 is our second passage. There again is the word whale, but it could be a great creature of the sea. But what I want to look at more specifically is what's mentioned in chapter 40 and chapter 41. Now, when we think about the book of Job, we're presented with this man, Job, who had 10 children and was one of the greatest men in the East, a very conscientious man. He offered sacrifices for his children every day, and his children feasted in their houses on their birthdays, and all of these bad things happened to Job. He loses all of his herds, his flocks, his possessions, and in the same day, and much more devastating than that, he loses all of his children as well. And then after that, he's smote with boils from his head to his feet, and his wife, the one that you would expect for him to get some comfort from, says, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And so we know the story from chapter 3, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, three of his friends, I'm going to put quotations around there, because they argue with him the rest of the time. They come to him and they say, "Well, you must have sinned, Job." And the Bible doesn't say that just because somebody suffers, that means that they have sinned. Remember in Luke 13, verses 1 through 5, when Jesus talks about those Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. That is, they were sacrificing and Pilate had killed them and shed their blood along with their sacrifices. Jesus asked, "Do you suppose that these were sinners above the rest?" And then he says, "I tell you nay. I tell you no. But except you repent, you shall all likewise perish." Or the Tower of Siloam. 18 people died in the falling of that tower. Apparently, it was well known enough that that's all Jesus had to mention. Kind of like in our days. In our day, if we say 9/11, everybody knows about that. Everybody. Well, Jesus says in verse 5, "Do you suppose that they were sinners above everybody else?" And he says, "I tell you no." Jesus says no. So anyway, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are not right in this. They're accusing Job of sin because he's suffering. And that's not exactly the case. That's not true. That's not good reasoning. And
they accuse him of sin, and Job is trying to defend himself. Well, in getting fed up with all this, and also having to deal with suffering, you know, many times I think we know the way that we ought to approach suffering when it happens to us, but actually going through it is harder. And as this wears on, Job does, you know, at some point say, God, why don't you answer me? Well, in Job 38, God really does answer him out of the whirlwind, and he says, gird up your loins, and I'll demand of thee, and answer thou me. We are going to have a conversation. So he's saying, basically, Job, roll up your sleeves. And he asks him all these questions about creation, like, how is it, what is the way that light's departed? Or, you know, where were you when I made the earth? Or where, you know, when I formed all the things in it? Or how is it the case that this eagle is able to fly this way and do this? Or how is it the case that a horse is not afraid in battle? He goes and talks about all these different things of creation, which even today, with all of our study in science, we really can't answer many of these. Because you keep asking questions and you find that we really don't know a whole lot, do we? But we get to Job chapter 40, and beginning at verse 15, we're introduced with this creature. And I think the reason that I wanted to look at the context of this, God's not just speaking hypothetically here in the sense that he's talking about a mythological creature. He has been citing things that are actually created. You know, explain to me how the horse does this. Explain to me how the hail and the rain works. Explain to me this. He's talking about things that he has actually created. And then he comes to verse 15 and he says, behold now behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force is in the navel of his belly. So apparently this is a great creature that eats grass, that would eat vegetation, and he has a big center, big belly. Well, there's a lot of big animals that would be like that, like an elephant or a hippo or maybe a dinosaur. But then notice verse 17. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. Well, the cedar was one of the biggest trees. Remember the cedars of Lebanon? They were used for the temple that was built by Solomon, right? Very famous. And some people have suggested, oh, he's just talking about an elephant or a hippopotamus.
They both have big tails, you
know. Yeah, they have enormous tails, don't they? They're pretty sorry, excuse for a tail, compared to the size of the animal, right? But what about an animal like a dinosaur? Like what we were talking about, who was standing up and would need that for balance. Standing up on two. Some people have said it's a crocodile. But, you know, as we read, you know, more of this and talk about it, this is something standing up. Have you ever seen a crocodile stand up on 2 feet? And, you know. So, the tail like a seer really points it out that this is something that I think is very much close to what we would think of. His bones are strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God, that he that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Surely the mountains bring him forth food where all the beasts of the field play. He lieth under the shady trees in the covert of the reed and fins. So not only is he talking about this creature, but he also talks about its habitat, where it lives, right? So it's not just something that God has made up. What God is saying here in chapter 40 and chapter 41 is, listen, you're not going to mess with this guy, and I created him. So what makes you think that you can question me? If you're not going to mess with him, then you shouldn't mess with his creator. And he really puts Job to silence here. And these are humbling questions that we should all ask ourselves. It puts you in your place. The Bible does. The Bible keeps you humble that way. Verse 22, the shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. Behold, he drinketh up a river and hasteth not. He trusteth that he can draw up Jordan in his mouth. He taketh it with his eyes. His nose pierceth through snares. So we have behemoth here. And then chapter 41, we have Leviathan. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook, or his tongue with a cord, which thou lettest down? Canst thou put a hook in his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn?
Will he make supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Will thou take him for a servant forever? Will thou play with him as with a bird, or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens? Shall the companions make a banquet of him? Shall they part him among the merchants? Obviously, this is a force to be reckoned with, not something that you just deal with lightly. Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons, or his head with fish spears? Lay thine hand upon him, remember the battle, do no more. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? So obviously a terrible creature. None is so fierce that dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand before me? That's the big point of all of this. You know, in some ways I don't want to focus so much on who these were, because the main point of what God is saying is you shouldn't mess with me if you're not messing with these things. But I think that they are very similar to what we would think of as far as a dinosaur or a dragon. Now, in talking about Leviathan here, there is a lot that is said here, if you read the rest of the chapter, that talks as if, you know, he can breathe fire. Verse 31, he makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. You go up a little bit, he esteemeth iron as straw, an arrow cannot take him, sling stones are turned to stubble. So the idea that he can breathe fire is chapter 41, verse 21. Or let's go up to verse 19. Or 18, sorry. Verse 18. By his sneezings a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go forth lamps, sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils go smoke, and out of a seething pot or cauldron, his breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. So, you know, the idea that maybe they breathe fire. I don't know exactly what this creature was. If he made the deep boil, then apparently he was able to go into water. But the behemoth and the leviathan seem to be very similar to what we've been studying here, these dinosaurs. And so I do think the Bible does mention it. I do think that man and dinosaur were existing at some point together on this earth, and the millions of years that they have for, you know, them being extinct in the past is just the same as all the other examples that we gave a couple lessons ago when we looked at, you know, this fish has been extinct for 70 million years and then we catch it off the coast of Madagascar. So obviously their timeline is flawed. They're interpreting everything in light of the theory that they already have in their heads. But when you really look at the evidence points to the fact that it's exactly as God said, that there were these great creatures that were created on the sixth day, the same day man was. Does anybody have any comments or questions before we stop for this evening?
What was that gentleman's name that came to focus this?
And
Was it on this part of the video that he talked about the evolutionist trying to buy that fossil off the guy?
No.
Okay. Well, I think it was just before that on there. He was talking about that somebody had, you know, evidence of a dinosaur, you know, in the belly of a mammal or something like that. But anyway, he's had many evolutionists approach him and offer him even up to $2 million for that fossil. And they've been very honest about what they want to do with it. They want to destroy it. So how is that for being honest with the, you know, with the evidence and taking the evidence wherever it leads? That's, you know.
I'm just going to say that he's coming back again this fall.
Brad Harris. Oh, that guy?
Yeah, Brad's been here before too. He was here 2006.
Yeah. And yeah. Greg just bought this recently. It's we're going to put in the library. There's 13 lessons, a series called Convicted, and it's on certain. You know, a lot of different subjects, but it'll be in the library. There's 6 DVDs in it, so if you want to check out anything else on that. All right, you guys have a good night. Hopefully you don't dream about dinosaurs.